Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's May 17th and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. So we've only got one guest today. We're going to be hopefully speaking to Council Member Shanae Williams. She's on the campaign trail. She's the incumbent Yonkers City Council member representing District 1. And she will face off against a challenger. There's one other challenger that I understand that she will face off against for the primary that will take place on June 25. And that's the day that of the two people running, of which one is Council Member Shanae Williams, the incumbent. She should win, then she'll be able to I don't think there's anybody else running against her on the Republican side of the equation. So that means that whoever wins this particular Democratic contest, they will be the presumptive winner of and also the candidate that will get voted in at the following was it in the regular in the general election in November. So what an unusual circumstance that we have in this particular year with the changes of collecting signatures, the campaign beginning so much earlier, and when it was usually right after the summer that people began campaigning, and that you had the general election later on in November. But so I see our guest is on. Good morning. Ms. Williams, how are you?
Hi, good morning, Hezzy. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
It's a pleasure very good, thank you. I'm glad that you're on, so thank you for calling and thank you for making the time for our audience. Well, there's congratulations in order. Evidently, you gained the endorsement of 1199 SEIU. So they're supporting your campaign effort, and they're a particularly powerful union. And 1199 SEIU is the United Healthcare Workers East. How does that resonate with you?
I'm actually extremely honored. I'm so excited about it because, like you said, they're a very powerful union here in New York, nationwide actually, and they have quite a lot. Of residents that live and work here in Yonkers
in the first district.
So I'm extremely excited about it. I was actually just with them yesterday at a candidates night, and they had, great questions. But, everyone's just really concerned about our public school district and about the safety concerns here in the district with all the, gun violence and all the teens. They need something to do, and parents are concerned, and they are rightfully, they have every right to be concerned. So everything that I'm working towards, my vision for Yonkers is really just to address those concerns and make sure that we, provide, enough resources for our kids in our schools and make sure that we fund our education. We're currently presented with a budget to raise the maintenance of effort and put an additional $12 million into our public schools. And I'm fully supportive of that, but I want to just make sure that that money is trickling down to the children, making sure that they have programs after school, making sure that they have arts and counselors and things like that. And I think that's what families deserve.
Well, once I ask you, where is this $12 million coming from?
It's coming from the city. We have the money in the budget for it. And in addition to that, I know the superintendent is asking us, because we just met with him this past week, he's asking us to bond an additional $5 million to help close that $17 million gap. And, and that's specifically to bond for books, textbooks, and equipment that is absolutely necessary. You can't take a child to school and ask them to learn when you don't have the resources to provide them,
Yeah, but I've always wondered, why are we in such an archaic state that we're still publishing books when all the information that's available in books is now available in free courses that are given by the Khan Academy that is part of the Microsoft system, and they allow this access to all this information, which is updated whenever new information comes out on whatever discipline it is, no matter what it is, and on every conceivable level, teaching level, for free. So why are we spending $5 million for publishing books?
Right. So I asked that question, if we can maybe step away from textbooks and move into towards using technology more, especially because studies show that our students in Yonkers do a lot better with computer-based testing than the traditional, paper. But I, the superintendent assured me that these textbooks are necessary because they're actually, there's multiple ways for kids to learn. Some kids are better at writing things down, and these textbooks aren't just textbooks that we think of them, that we're used to, like, you know, these are actually workbooks that they can actually write in and do the problems in. So that's what it is.
Excuse the terminology, his ignorance, but he can say whatever he wants. But the point is, if people feel better literally writing and working out equations, that's why we have a loose leaf, and they could use whatever is on the internet. They could print it out, number one. And they can put that into their loose leaf, and they can work off of that if that's what they're more comfortable with. And yes, we should incorporate all those modalities.
There's other ways to go around it. And I think that eventually we will have to make that investment into maybe tablets or computers to make sure that every student has that and they can work off of that.
Well, tablets are cheap too. You know, tablets cost a hell of a lot less than, they have these Chromebooks now. They cost less than $100 a unit. And you know what?
Right.
Considering all the money we would spend in getting that, we can even give these tablets to the kids for no cost. It won't cost us $5 million.
Let's say we give every student a tablet to take home. What happens when the student doesn't have internet at home? They can't do their homework. They can't do what they have to do.
No, I've heard
that becomes
argument,
another problem.
You know what? No, it's not a problem because you can get them for $10 a month.
I think that
is something
that we have to move towards.
I'm not arguing with you, but the people understand. They're not stupid. And the point is that these sort of flippant responses from the Board of Education and particularly the superintendent of schools is just disconcerting to an unbelievable degree because he's spending money that we don't have. And you know what? There is a way to resolve that as well. You can get internet service for under 10 bucks a month. That even if you incorporate that for free, it won't cost you more than the cost of books. And, you know, even more importantly, if people couldn't even have that, then maybe we should keep the schools open till 9 o'clock at night or 8 o'clock at night and have parents pick up their kids at that hour so that they could study at that point. It's not unheard of.
That is done all over the world. That makes so much sense, Heavy. But as we are right now, we have schools that don't offer after school programs because we can't afford to pay teachers, to stay late and help our kids. You know,
I literally
have a cousin that was working on a project at Saunders High School, and she needed to use a sewing machine, and she doesn't have one at home. And I'm like, well, why don't you just stay after school and do it there? And she's like, because we only have after school once a week. And that to me is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
That is a disservice to her and all the other students at that school and all of our public schools. And we have to do better.
People forget that by disenfranchising the educational process to the benefit of the student population, it not only hurts them and curtails their prospects in life, but it also diminishes the quality and the capacity of even people of older age because there's no one that will be able to fill in those gaps of people that are dying.
Right.
So, you know, maybe we don't have to wait for you to drop dead at 90, but, you know, there are people who need the services of educated people at 30 and 40 and 50 and 60 and so on. And this is the disconnect. And there's such a bias. To me, it's palpable. I don't understand why we can't get on board and make a commitment to educating our population. And whether they're immigrants or whether they're from, they've been living here for generations, I don't understand the demeanor.
What can I tell you? I agree with
you. Well, another thing that's interesting, because you've got a lot of information then about education. There was a meeting this past week as well, and on the last and final day to get a short-term bond for 2 years was cast in front of the city council membership, and they had to vote on it. It was like, if they didn't vote on it, then Cross Hill Academy would sink under the fact that they failed for 4 years in educating their particular school population. And that actually, to me, falls on the back of the superintendent of school who has failed. The kids don't fail. The kids need the capacity to learn, and they need to be given that food so that they can learn. And so evidently they've been failed by a system that has failed them. And now of the $95 million being borrowed, $25 or $24 million will be used to resurrect the school. That's like free money coming from the state because they have to. And that was all done at the behest of the superintendent. I don't know if the city council, I think the city council had to acquiesce to this last minute assault on their sensibilities, but that was never put in the budget.
Right. And that's something that actually, I know, was discussed or even at the budget hearing the other day with our finance team too, because they're the ones that have to come before us for this request. And it's something that we have to plan for more effectively in the future. And I think we're all aware of that now. And, you know, we're asking the right questions now. And, you know, remember, this is a fairly new council for the most part. And
I trust that as we
continue through this process this year, we'll be better prepared for the future. We'll budget better, we'll plan better. And it takes the entire team, it takes the administration and the city council to make that happen. So go ahead.
Just finish your thought, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine.
Well, I'm just very, very pleased that you're on top of it, because it shows me that you have the capacity to and the will and the drive, and now the understanding as well to maintain a forward movement as you engage in this June 25 primary against, I think you only have one other contender that's challenging you, and there will be no challenger from the Republican side that I'm aware of.
So it's
whoever wins this particular June 25 primary in the Democratic Party will be the actual winner of, and the outcome is that you would get reelected, whoever that winner is. So that they would become the next city council member. And what other challenges do you find that are like very, very compelling and that the people in your district are asking you to look into?
Outside of education, one of the other challenges is just making sure that we have, you know, the resources that's going directly into the community as far as quality of life is concerned. There's a lot of people that's also concerned about the housing situation here, and they have every right to be. You know, they want to make sure that they're taxpayers. They want to make sure that their funds that they're giving into the city is not just going to developers to come in and build here, and they are on the outs, right? So they want to make sure that they get some community benefits from all this development. And I agree with them. I think that, you know, as these projects come before us, we have to kind of have those tough conversations with the developers. We have to take a risk, and you know, if they're going to threaten to leave, then that's something that we will have to deal with. And I think that's something that the community will be okay with, because we want people who want to come here and build here and invest here for the long term, you know. And
well,
that, doing so,
all those are perfect ideas. Do we have in Yonkers? Do we have a consensus among the city council membership, as well as the mayor's office, with regard to the component of affordable housing allocations in a building structure? Or has that yet to be devised from a legislative perspective?
It is still something that we are working on. Right. It is
okay.
Still something that we are working on. Certainly. I know I can only speak for myself and based on the conversations that I've had with the Democrats on the council. As far as affordable housing
okay.
goes, we are having conversations constantly about how we can make it work so that the mayor can get on board and not veto it, because we do want to make sure that we do the right thing and not have to go backwards and have to fix anything later. We want to do it now,
right.
Improve the ordinance that we have, and make sure that it gets passed and that everyone benefits from it, you know. So that's something that we're still working on.
Well, I heard before also that you mentioned that you were concerned that developers might be dissuaded from coming to Yonkers. But considering the vibrancy in the population and all the attributes of the city of Yonkers, just being across the border from New York, and a lot of people are leaving New York, whether it be from Brooklyn or from Manhattan, and they're moving to Westchester, and they're moving north,
mm-hmm.
Which has always been the situation anyway. People who came to Yonkers, many of them, maybe a couple of generations ago, came from the Bronx. Many people in Yonkers
mm-hmm.
moved up the food chain, if that's what you want to call it, to Yorktown
mm-hmm.
and to Mayapat. So this is a constant
right.
Change. And the impetus or the catalyst may have been financial capacity, or just that it would be a little bit easier financially to move into a place like Yonkers. But don't you think, because of the vibrancy of this city, that there are enough other developers that would be able to move in case some people want to get a deal where basically they're raping us and we could get a much more balanced approach from developers? Is that off?
I don't think you're off. I agree with you. I do think that we do exactly have that vibrancy that, you know, developers absolutely want to come here. But it had to start somewhere, and started with, you know, the big names, you know, that we see going up now, the Avalon and the RXR and Mill Creek and so on.
Right.
But if ever, like, you know, Ginsburg or, you know, decide to step away because they're putting pressure on and demanding more for the community, then I think the city of Yonkers will be okay, because people are already looking at Yonkers. People are already moving into Yonkers, and I don't think
right.
that we're going to see a drastic change anytime soon. So I don't think that it's a major concern
for
like the majority. Right. Right.
Right.
But I think that at the same time, developers are very
yeah.
willing to work with the city. They've certainly been coming in and entertaining our conversations, and they've been meeting with the community more, at least you know, since we've asked them to. They've been open to it, and I think that's a very positive thing. It shows that we can work with them, and we can, you know, get things done. And that's what I would like to see. I would like to see an effort of public-private partnership that works for the community at large, and everyone benefits from it.
Well, that's an interesting phrase. I want to get back to that as well. The PP3, the P3, as they call it, the public-private
right.
partnership. But so, I concur with you that, and you make a very salient point, and that is that we needed to begin someplace, and we did begin someplace as far as economic development is concerned. And it didn't happen overnight. It maybe has been happening
right.
in the last 25, 30 some odd years, give or
yeah.
take. You know, there's no exact moment, but certainly there are more developers. There's more stuff happening. There are more businesses here. But we're also changing the landscape. So it looks a little different,
mm-hmm.
and there's an interest. There's that Generation Yonkers promotion, you know, which is very compelling. I don't know if we reached all that, the adulation of the commercials, but we certainly reached to a new level. And so we're at a much better place than we ever were. Do you find that we're really in a better place as far as attracting development?
Yes, I do. I believe that we are. And I think it's a good thing. But again, we just have to be careful that we don't forget about the community that's been here for decades. We want to make sure that they have a hold here and not get pushed out as we bring in new developers.
So you're talking about gentrification, that financially, the influence of financial capacity may push
right.
some of our population out of the city? And is there a way
right.
to protect them? Is there a way to protect them?
That's the thing. I've been looking into this personally, just looking at how other cities have dealt with, you know, economic development and gentrification
mm-hmm.
as a whole. And I don't know if there is one way to protect them. And I think that's what we're working on. And that's why we introduced items like the affordable housing. That's why we talk about having community benefits program. That's why we try to have these conversations now to see how we can make sure that we're investing in the surrounding areas where this development is happening, you know.
That's a very interesting point. There was something that you might want to look at, and that is what just recently passed in the city of White Plains. There are HUD standards for affordable housing. However,
right.
they are much higher than many people that live in Yonkers, for example, could afford. So the standards are
mm-hmm.
very, very high, and it's a break, of course, but it's not what's conducive. And what they did in White Plains, and this only passed last week, was that they would have a new guideline that's set by the city of White Plains, which would impose new standards of affordability, and those standards would give an opportunity for people like in the least well-off district in Yonkers, where the median average income, the median income is like about $45,000 a year, and
mm-hmm.
They have housing like that for a family of four for $50,000, and that actually helps support the infrastructure of people who are well-off. And then all the people who do the work that you don't expect from a lawyer or a doctor or a scientist or a teacher, but you might expect it from a police officer or a fireman or people that are not earning the same amount of money, as well as workers who are the people who serve us at the restaurants.
Right.
So maybe that's
something to look at.
You need
to have a balance. You need a mix. Absolutely.
Right. Because we
right.
can't all live if everybody's a doctor and a scientist and a school teacher, then who's doing the rest of the work?
Right. And
what living conditions
are they living in, you know?
Exactly. So that's part of, that seems to, that just passed, you might want to look into that. I think you'll find it
okay.
very compelling and a very smart move, because it shows the complexity and the balancing act that's required.
Okay.
So that's important. What about infrastructure? Does that matter to the district?
Yes, it does. You know, and we have, for a few years now, we've been doing the Clean Streets Project, the Complete Streets, Complete Streets Project here in Yonkers. And just the other day, we actually, one of our homeowners, community associations, HARCA, Hudson River Community Association, actually had the administration come in and educate the community on what's been happening, what they've done, and what they're continuing to do. Certainly in the first district, everyone can see that Ashburton has been, what's the word I'm looking for? Repaved the entire corridor of Ashburton was done, and we're actually continuing to do several road pavements. I've submitted a number of streets in the first district that haven't been touched in years that need resurfacing. So we're doing that process now that the weather is warmer, it's getting warmer. And I think also in addition to that, I think what I want to get out there is for people to know that if they see something in their neighborhood that needs to be addressed, so we're not always aware of it. You have to call us and let us know. You have to, let us know what's happening so that we can send a team out there and do an assessment and understand what needs to be done, and then so that we can budget for it and address it in the future. That's, how it works, and a lot of people just aren't aware of that. But I'm glad that you brought that up.
That's a very, very important issue. And so people need to recognize that they're an integral part of this relationship of government and self-governance, and that they have you as their representative, but they need to advise you because they may be traveling on a particular street or they may see something of pertinence that you may not be aware of because you can't be traveling and, reviewing the city every day. Things happen every day. So you need to be informed. Maybe that's something that's a brilliant move on your part. Maybe that needs to be a presentation that can be promoted by the city in its entirety. I remember, and this is way before your time, there was a woman in the 6th District, Dee Barbato, and she was really beside herself because they had not paved any streets in the 6th District for 20 years that she was aware of, and that was 10 years ago that she was last on the city council. I don't know if they've done that. Do we have a formula for the city that designates what needs to be done and before it decays and totally disintegrates?
Well, our Department of Public Works and our engineer, our traffic engineer, usually go out into the field and they'll, take note of what streets, what roads need to be fixed, what bridges and so on. And they'll, do a full assessment, see how much it costs, and they'll put money in their budget. But also the city council, each of us council members get a portion of money on a yearly basis that we can put towards road pavements. And that is why it is important. Like, we only get like $500,000 each, but we need to know where those streets are that are in dire need of attention. I personally like to drive around and look at the different neighborhoods because it's easy for me to see what's happening in downtown and Getty Square because I live there, but I may not know what's happening on Upper Warburton or down on Riverdale or in Ludlow if I don't physically make it a point to go there. So I'll drive around the neighborhood and I'll see how bad Buena Vista needs repavement. And so while we communicate with our traffic engineer in DPW and vice versa, we still have to do our part and let them know, okay, I think this street really needs to be addressed. You know, Jody Lane hasn't been touched in 30 years. I know it's a dead end, but there are people that live there and they deserve to have, a nice road to drive on. So we can look at addressing that and then traffic engineer will come back to me and say, well, this costs about $300,000 or, and they'll rate it. There's a rating system that they give us, fives, four, three, twos, and one, four, and threes. Fives mean that they are in really bad shape and they have to get done because their life expectancy is just very, very low, right? We have to, they'll rate them fives if they have to get done ASAP. And then, threes if they can wait a few years, and so on. So, and then we'll know how much based on the money that we have and how much each road costs, then we'll decide, okay, we want this road done this year, and we'll save the next for next year or so on.
That is really terrific.
So that is,
well, if you I see we're like already, I can't believe a half hour goes so quickly, especially when we got such a compelling person at the other end of the phone. Do you have a moment to talk a little bit about the public-private partnership concept that you brought up?
Sure.
So how can we incorporate public-private partnership in the city of Yonkers?
Well, you know that we're already doing that with the Rebuild Yonkers campaign, Rebuild Yonkers Public School campaign. There are three new schools that are to be built in Yonkers. Two of them will be in the first district, and those are going to be public-private partnerships. The city will put a lot of funding into it. We provide the property. We provide the land, and we get developers to come in and build, and we work with them financially to make sure that it can get done in a timely manner. The state and the city both fund these this campaign, and so what happens is when we eventually acquire all of the properties that we need and we have a master plan, we go into the community and we do the whole secret process. We have people, we have public meetings so that people can ask questions, give comments, whether it has to do with the traffic or whether doing a traffic study or whether it has to do with an environmental study and so on. And so everyone gets to be involved in the process. And I think that's a beautiful thing, and we need more of that.
It's a process, and there's nothing wrong with the process, but the biggest issue really is the financial aspect of it. So,
Yeah,
there may be a little bit of money coming from the state, there may be a little bit of money coming from the city, but predominantly this all falls on the back of whoever the financial institution is that's going to put up the money to build. And but I thought that the real the gravitas of the public-private partnership is knowing up front exactly how long it would take to pay off this construction, and that in a sense it's the financial institution, it could be a bank, it could be a some fund, whatever it is, or an investment fund or whatever, and we would know how much we would need to pay and how long it would take us to pay, and that would be a guarantee so that it would never go beyond that. And have we engaged in anything like that yet? Because I didn't think we did.
No,
where
but
do
that
we have
is something that is I don't think we have that I'm aware of. But this is something that
neither am
will
I
happen
aware.
Once.
I'm not aware of it.
Yeah. So this is something that will happen once we start the next phase of the rebuild campaign. You will be seeing that happen. Hopefully in the next year or two.
Okay. So, but I guess we need to start off with knowing how much this project is going to cost and how it's going to be put together. One thing I've always found missing in a lot of these discussions where there are meetings and it's supposed to engage all the stakeholders and all the people that are interested in the community, it all sounds really nice. Except it's really the biggest farce going, because I remember once going to one of these, and that was the last I ever attended, and they asked me what I thought was pertinent for the area, and I said, hey, that's your job. You're supposed to tell me what you're building, because we want to build the corridor in a particular development site, then what are you going to do about the width of the street? So what... do you want me to, if I want a bordello, are you going to build it because that's what I want? I mean, it's not what I want, it's what's
right.
So
they
for
have
the
to
community.
Come with a plan, and then you can enhance it, right, and tell them if it works
Correct.
Or if it doesn't work.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Right, but that's
if we
so
want
the thing about that is
we
most
need to
people,
have a street wide enough to manage a
right.
big truck. Not that
right.
they design a community where the only thing that can function might be a little. Superette where the costs are so high that nobody can afford to go there, which is, undermines the whole basis of what we're trying to do. So
right.
Very, very,
I think sometimes
there's
people don't think about it in that way. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you do, and I do.
Yeah.
There are some people who think in the city of Yonkers. Thank God for that. So so what else do you have to do at this moment? Because are you still out there, you know, campaigning? Does this
yes,
stop
I
or
am
does it
still
not
out there.
End?
No,
okay.
No, I'm out there. I have volunteers out there knocking on doors, canvassing.
Okay.
And, you know, it's difficult for me sometimes, at least this time of year, because we have the budget process going on, the budget hearings. And so I try to find a balance where I can make time to go out there. Weekends are really usually, you know, the most time that I have available to really work on the campaign
right.
myself outside of, like, you know, once I get out of council meetings and things. But I do have a team of volunteers out there working diligently and very, you know, very dedicated people that support me, and I'm grateful for them. And
okay,
it's going
so
good. It's going very good.
Can you share your secret? Do you sleep only 2 hours or is it 3 hours at night? I mean, where do you find the time to do all this? Because there's a budget, there's a, you know, driving to different sections of your district and seeing what needs to be done. How do you find the time for this? Or do you just don't sleep?
I'll be honest, Hezzy. I think personally, because I've changed my diet over the past couple of years, and, you know, I subscribe to a plant-based diet for the most part. I have a lot of energy because of that. I feel, you know, I try to squeeze in, you know, time once, you know, maybe two or three times a week to work out. I think just having that positive, you know, energy around me all the time really helps me keep going. I know I've ran into a few people and they're like, "You look tired." And I'm like, "I'm always tired, but I, you know, it's important. I have to grind. I have to grind every day because
right.
I want this really badly because I care about Yonkers and I care
right.
about the work that I'm doing and I, you know, I want to continue to do it." So, you know, I know that we say that there's never enough time in the day. There's time when you make time for what you want. And, you know,
that's
I find
true.
A way to make the time for what I want to do. So it works.
So what caused you to adopt
And also,
this
I'll
new,
be honest,
go ahead.
Just one last thing. I used to always say that I don't
uh-huh.
drink coffee. I hate it. I find myself drinking coffee recently at least once or twice a week, which is not normal for me at all. I'm usually just a tea person, but that helps.
Me too. Yeah, the tea helps. I've been drinking green tea for a long time. It makes me feel good. But I wanted to ask you then, are you talking about like a vegan diet?
I tried, I was vegan for about 7 months, like last year, but then it was just too much to keep up with. And I really, just really missed seafood. So I'm more of a pescatarian than anything, but for the most part, I just don't eat meat. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's okay. I mean, but the point is, protein from fish is really excellent.
Right.
It's funny
right.
you should mention that because I made like a boiled salmon. That's what I had yesterday with asparagus. So yeah, I'm moving more fish and very little meat nowadays. So I must be using your diet, even though I just I didn't read a formal, thing about it. But that's good. Well, this is very compelling. I hope we'll be talking again in another couple of weeks. So get a little bit of rest and drink more tea and more fish. Sounds good.
Thank you, Hezzy. Thank you for having me on the show.
Wait,
can I just point out that I have go ahead.
Go ahead. Did you have what?
Okay, I was just going to say I have a fundraiser coming up
on
Thursday. May 23rd, it's on my birthday. I'm turning 30, and I hope that, you know, anyone listening who's supporting me would come out and celebrate with me. You can find the information on my website. I'm going to direct people there, SheneeWilliams.com. But it's May 23rd at Zuka's Restaurant, 59 Main Street, at 6:30 p.m.
At which restaurant? Oh, that was a Zupa. That's
Zupa?
Right. I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zupa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that should be a lot of fun. But I mean, did you ever put 30 candles on a cake? I mean, this
no.
is like fantastic. This will be your first time.
No, I'm definitely not going to do that.
Okay.
But
okay.
maybe I'll get like a big trio. Or maybe
okay.
I won't even have
I like
cake.
That.
I don't know. I'm not a cake person, Hezzy.
All right.
It
well,
doesn't
it's
go with my diet.
For others that do. That's a better idea. Okay. Well, all the best. Thank you
all
very
right.
much for spending
Thank
the
you.
Time with us. I appreciate it. Be well.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, there we have it, folks, Council Member Shanae Williams. She's on the campaign trail, and it was yesterday that she got the endorsement of 1199 SEIU. And SEIU is a large employer and part of the Service Employees International Union. They have over 300,000 members in the New York metropolitan area. And would you believe this? They have a large number of working families who live in the council district's area, so in Council District 1. And these are professionals, United Healthcare Workers East is what 1199 SEIU represent, and very, very interesting. Well, I like the concept, too, that Shanae Williams brought up about the public-private partnership. That'll be interesting if they get this thing together. There was a time when they talked about this, but I don't know. I'm always bad at dates or, you know, but I get the impression that it was maybe close to 8 or 10 years ago when there was talk about a public-private partnership, but it never went anywhere. It was, and it seems like it really should be very, very good and a very, it helps to budget more than anything else. It helps to budget and know the cost of a particular product that you're building. So if you're building a school, if you're building an apartment building, whatever it is, the public-private partnership will define in advance exactly what the costs will be over a particular length of time and how long it would take to pay it off. And it's a guarantee because that's the agreement and cannot be changed. So that's the beauty of it. And that becomes very helpful when budgeting for a project, a very large project. And it's just a very, very compelling idea. So hopefully we'll find what they're going to be doing in the next 4 years from 2020 onward. The next 4 years will be very, very interesting. So we'll see where it all goes. Well, let me quickly take a break here for a moment and see what's happening nationally. Because there's a lot that's been happening nationally, and it's important to recognize. Evidently, Chelsea Manning has been sent back to jail after refusing to testify in the WikiLeaks inquiry. So the former U.S. military intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning was ordered back to jail on Thursday, yesterday, for refusing to testify before a grand jury believed to be investigating WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Now, Andy Stepanian, a spokesman for Manning's legal team, said she had been remanded in custody by Judge Anthony Trenga for contempt of court after again refusing to provide testimony. Now, Manning, who spent 7 years in military prisons for leaking U.S. secrets to WikiLeaks back in 2010, and then 2 more months in an Alexandria, Virginia, jail this year on contempt charges, had said before the hearing that she would again refuse to testify. I'm not going to comply with this grand jury, she told journalists outside the Alexandria courthouse before the hearing. And according to the Washington Post, U.S. District Court Judge Trenga sent Manning back to jail. He ordered a fine of $500 a day if she does not testify within 30 days, raising that to $1,000 a day if she does not testify within 60 days. The newspaper quoted Manning as saying, quote, "The government cannot build a prison bad enough, cannot create a system worse than the idea that I would ever change my principles. I would rather starve to death than to change my opinions in this regard," she said. "I mean that quite literally," she said. The judge, the Washington Post said, responded by telling Manning, quote, "There's nothing dishonorable in discharging your responsibility as a U.S. citizen," end quote. And Manning has accused the government of seeking to revive her original court-martial case, saying that prosecutors were unhappy over her 2017 pardon by President Barack Obama. Quote, "The goal here is really to relitigate the court-martial," Manning said before the hearing. "They didn't like the outcome. I got out." Manning was 31, was called early this year, to testify to a grand jury, a panel investigating major crimes that operates in secrecy, about her work with Assange and WikiLeaks 9 years ago. She said that the government was abusing the grand jury process and refused to testify, saying she had answered all the questions years before anyway. A judge found her in contempt, and on March 8, she was jailed indefinitely. She was released last week when the grand jury's mandate expired and was called to testify before a new one on Thursday, which she said was seeking answers to the same set of questions. While she was not at liberty to discuss the specifics of the investigation, she indicated that it also was a probe of Assange and WikiLeaks action in 2010. Now, the U.S. Justice Department has asked Britain to extradite Assange to stand trial in the United States for conspiracy for advising Manning on breaking into a restricted U.S. government computer. Assange, now committed to a British prison for a year and also facing an extradition effort from Sweden, asserts that he is a journalist with the right to publish purloined secrets. Manning, a transgender woman whom supporters call a whistleblower, said the new grand jury case is meaningless since the Justice Department already unveiled its charges against Assange. "The case doesn't make sense. It's very bananas," she said. "Ultimately, this is an attempt to place me back into confinement." So that is what's going on with her. Now, this is really very interesting as well. Evidently, President Trump has unveiled new immigration plans to favor skills over family ties. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump said yesterday he wants to overhaul the immigration system to favor educated English-speaking applicants with job offers instead of people with family ties to Americans, a plan with little chance of advancing in Congress. Well, Trump's plan, roundly panned by Democrats and immigration advocacy groups, is aimed at trying to unite Republicans, some who want to boost immigration, others who want to restrict it ahead of the November 2020 presidential and congressional elections. If, for some reason, possibly political, we can't get the Democrats to approve this merit-based high-security plan, then we will get it approved immediately after the elections when we take back the House of Representatives, keep the Senate, and, of course, hold the presidency, Trump said in a Rose Garden address to Republican lawmakers and cabinet members. Currently, about two-thirds of the 1.1 million people allowed to emigrate to the United States each year are given green cards granting permanent residency because of family ties. Now, Trump proposed keeping the overall numbers steady, but shift to a merit-based system similar to one used in Canada, a plan he said would result in 57% of green cards to be based on employment and skills. Ahead of the speech, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, quote, "merit," end quote, was a, quote, "condescending," end quote, term. "Are you saying family is without merit? Are you saying most of the people who have ever come to the United States in the history of our country are without merit because they don't have an engineering degree? Pelosi told reporters. The plan was developed by Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner and Stephen Miller, an advisor known for his hard line on immigration issues. Democratic support would be needed to advance any legislation through the Republican-led Senate, let alone the Democratic-controlled House. So Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer criticized the White House for failing to consult with Democratic lawmakers and said that showed the proposal was not serious. Trump's plan included proposals to beef up security at the border to try to prevent people from crossing illegally, and legal changes aimed at curbing a flood of Central American migrants seeking asylum. But it left aside the thorny issue of how to deal with the roughly 11 million immigrants living in the country illegally, many for years, and protections for Dreamer children brought to the country illegally, a top priority of Democratic lawmakers. Quote, to say it's dead on arrival would be generous, said Phil Tobar, deputy director of America's Voice, a group that advocates for undocumented immigrants. The plan also does not include provisions to help farmers and other seasonal employers obtain more guest workers or reforms for technology visa programs. Now, business groups said the plan was a good first step, but emphasized solutions needed to be broader and bipartisan. It should also incorporate policies to improve access to temporary workers with skills needed in the marketplace and provide a practical solution for undocumented immigrants and those living under temporary relief from removal, including Dreamers. The Business Roundtable, a group of chief executives from large companies, said in a statement. So that's what's happening there, and a very, very compelling outcome. And one second, I wanted to speak to you about this as well. Evidently, the Venezuelan government and Democratic opposition meet for talks in Norway. So talks are underway in Norway between Venezuela's government and Democratic opponents, an envoy said on Thursday, in a possible search for a mediated solution following a failed uprising against President Nicolas Maduro. Yes, there are talks between the Bolivarian government and the democratic sectors of the opposition. Venezuela's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Jorge Valero, told reporters denouncing U.S. interference. Calling Maduro a dictator, U.S. President Donald Trump has tightened sanctions against his government and spearheaded international recognition of opposition leader Juan Guaido, who in January invoked the Constitution to assume the interim presidency. The Venezuelan government is a dialogue-loving government, Valero added, calling Trump a war criminal. Quote, unfortunately, there's also an opposition that is warmongering, terrorist, and fascist, simply puppets of the U.S. government, end quote. Guaido, who calls Maduro's 2018 re-election fraudulent, called for Venezuela's military to rise up on April 30, but his push quickly petered out, and the military's top brass has since then sworn allegiance to Maduro. Norway's foreign ministry said its norm was not to comment on possible roles in ongoing or potential peace talks. Quote, Norway follows the situation in Venezuela with great concern. We strongly encourage the parties to find a political and peaceful solution in order to avoid further escalation, a ministry spokeswoman had said. Many Venezuelan opposition supporters are skeptical about mediation talks, given that past rounds have failed, divided the opposition, and in their view, merely bought time for Maduro to consolidate power and quash street protests. Valero gave no specific details about the Norway talks. Information Minister Jorge Rodriguez and Miranda, State Governor Hector Rodriguez of the ruling Socialist Party, both traveled to Oslo, according to opposition sources. opposition legislator Stalin Gonzalez, along with political advisors Gerardo Blyde and Fernando Martinez, have also gone, they said. And Norway has a tradition of conflict mediation, including assistance with Colombia's 2016 peace deal between the government and the FARC rebels. So very, very compelling. We'll see if this leads anywhere. You just never know. And want to check on something else, which is really interesting. This is a fighting the scourge of human trafficking in Florida. This is a focus report. Listen in. This is a program prepared by Patrick Lovett and Rebecca Martin. Listen in, and this comes from, you listen and you'll hear it all. 1 second. It's about almost 6 minutes long.
He was the first person she told her story to. Tina waited nearly 20 years before revealing to her husband the unimaginable. When Tina was just 4 years old, her mother prostituted her and sold her to men on American soil.
As a child, being sold to men over and over again, every day I wanted to die, every single day. And I really didn't think I would live past my teenage years.
At 15, Tina escaped without saying anything, without filing a complaint, keeping this terrible trauma to herself.
What happens when you have PTSD, there's going to be a trigger that triggers something. And so when my daughters got to be about the age that I first encountered the trauma, I had a breakdown. I was anorexic. I had gotten down to about 70 pounds, and I was trying to kill myself. I was hospitalized for 2 months, and that's when they started the therapy for me, and when they started bringing up the memories.
Since this happened to Tina, human trafficking has grown steadily and silently in the United States. Florida is now one of the most affected states. Here, buses and signs alert families. 67% of the victims are young Americans, and one person per day falls victim to human trafficking. According to one lawyer, that number does not include the people who are too scared to talk.
Here in Florida, we see a lot of Americans being victimized. We've defined human trafficking in Florida to be modern-day slavery, and anybody could be a victim. So rich, poor, any race, any nationality, anybody could potentially be a victim. So really the difference between people that are victimized and not is vulnerability. Our traffickers look for vulnerability.
The preferred method of traffickers? Kidnapping runaways aged 12 to 14. Maurice Edwards is in charge of finding them. This detective is a member of the Youth Brigade. Their main investigative tool, the internet.
Okay, so you agree that it is a young girl?
Yeah. She's definitely, at least at minimum, given that illusion there.
If she's young. Okay, perfect.
I mean, it could be.
Every day, the unit analyzes online prostitution ads to identify possible cases of exploited minors.
Do you think these pictures are taken by somebody, or she set the camera there? We look for certain things that we look for when we're scrolling through these ads. If they look young, if someone else is taking the pictures, and certain verbiage that they use within the profile. So we look for certain clues that may indicate their involvement in trafficking.
This team spots nearly 10 suspicious ads a day. The next step happens on the field, surveillance work. The investigator targeted a hotel that was popular amongst traffickers.
Due to the low cost for the rooms, they prefer this hotel because less money that they spend on a room, the more money they keep in their pocket.
On site, Maurice Edwards looks for suspicious behavior. And after a couple of minutes, one white car gets his attention. Two men came out of it with a very young girl.
They were looking very suspicious. He looked at her, said choice of words. She was staring at us the entire time while we were filming. And then he eventually got into his car, and then, which is still there, And then she walked away while continually staring at us the whole time. She was dressed as, in a manner, for signs that we look for.
The girl will be identified a few days later on a prostitution ad. She is a minor who has been reported missing. This is the beginning of a new investigation. The unit saves an average of 2 minors per month.
How's he doing right now?
He's doing great. He really is. He's learning how to be on his own as an 18-year-old, which can be hard.
A lot of struggle.
This therapist has specialized in caring for victims of modern slavery. She and her team are treating about 50 patients.
For so long about his success story.
A lot of times what happens when a young person is exploited or is trafficked, they lose their sense of self. They do whatever the trafficker tells them to do, or they do whatever it is they need to do to survive. So what we try to do is help them define what it is they want to be. What are their personal goals?
Good morning.
Tina has since found a new purpose in life.
How's it going, Devon?
Good.
In her community coffee shop, she welcomes victims on a voluntary basis, and she shares her story with the customers.
Only 5% make it out and are able to be successful. I want to change that. And I didn't tell my story for many, many years.
I think that's the worst nightmare. It would be something happened to my kids. So anything that supports a good cause like this, supporting to prevent or fight the human trafficking, I'm up to it.
All of the profits from the coffee shop are donated to our anti-trafficking association.
They offer.
Tina and her husband have already helped 15 women in the past year.
Wow. Very, very compelling stuff. So that's really, really interesting. Bear with me a moment. I see that it's 11 o'clock. So what we're going to do is we're going to conclude for the day, and we'll speak on Monday. Monday is interesting because, unfortunately, Michael Edelman won't be with us this coming Monday. He's undergoing some surgery, and so he won't be able to attend. Bear with me a moment here. I wanted to make sure. Right. Yes. So that's on the 20th. So the 1 minute. Okay. So that's going to. So on Monday we're going to just speak to. Wait. I'm looking at the wrong date somehow. At least I thought so. No, okay. So, all right. So it looks like I think we're fine here. Let me just look to see. Yeah, we're going to have, I see what we have. We're going to speak to John Bailey from 10 o'clock to 10:30. From 10:30 to 11, we're going to speak to Olesubomi McCauley. She's running in the 3rd district. And then we're going to speak to Terrence Miller. He's running for the city council in the 1st district. And then we'll have about a half hour left to cover some news with you, local or national or international news with you. So that's the story. Wish you a great weekend. Thank you for being with us. And I want to thank again Council Member Shanae Williams. Very compelling. And I think that was really good. So we learned a great deal about her interest and her involvement and her knowledge. So she's not unaware. That's so pertinent because quite often people in the city council, they don't speak up enough so that we don't really know where they're at and what they're doing. But evidently she's done very well. Okay, so that's the story for us. We'll speak to you on Monday. Have a great weekend and all the best to you. Bye.